Ted Leonsis has had quite a few months. The Capitals and Wizards, which Leonsis owns through his Monumental Sports and Entertainment Company, were set to move into a new $2 billion complex in Northern Virginia before being thwarted in a heated battle with local community and political leaders. Then, last week, Leonsis announced a recommitment to and reimagining of the team's DC homes. They aren't going anywhere now for quite a long time. Leonsis joins us later in the show to make sense of it all and to detail what happened exactly in Virginia. Plus, the Final Four is set, and we'll take stock of what the rise in women's college basketball means for the future of the sport. It's Monday, April 1st. Happy April Fool's Day. I'm Eric Fisher, sitting in for Owen Poindexter. That's no prank, and this is Front Office Sports Today. Time now for our next Business of the Madness segment.
Business of the Madness is brought to you by Acura, which is now introducing the all-electric ZDX. Crafted using the same formula that brought them electrified supercars, the ZDX is Acura's most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy at Acura.com. The Final Four is approaching amid a boom in women's basketball. Joining me now to discuss is Front Office Sports reporter Amanda Kristovich. Welcome, Amanda.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, great to have you on. So, zooming out here, what have you learned about the growth of women's college basketball this year?
I think that the number one thing that I've learned, I think that the storyline of this year in the growth of women's college basketball has been the hype surrounding Caitlin Clark, you know, the Caitlin Clark effect that I wrote about, that many others have written about, the ticket sales, the increased ratings, this obsession, you know, with this record breaker, essentially, right? And, you know, someone who's considered the best college basketball player currently playing, men's or women's. But I think what I've learned about that is that I think Caitlin Clark is bringing out enthusiasm that was already there. Not all, you know, not 100%, right? A lot of new, there are a significant amount of fans who have discovered women's college basketball through Caitlin Clark. But I think in many cases, she is, you know, not just, there have been other Caitlin Clarks, you know, and there have been other incredible female college basketball players who have gotten, who have broken records and gotten incredible amounts of, you know, fanfare. But this is the first time that you combine a star like that with the visibility on broadcast television, with the, you know, the coverage on social media, with the investment in the sport post NCAA equity. This is the first time we're really seeing the power of all of those things to give people the opportunity who already have been fans of women's college basketball, visibility in their own right. And so I think like that's been the most interesting thing to see this season.
You mentioned the media coverage here. ESPN, of course, just signed this deal with the NCAA for a bunch of tournaments, namely the women's NCAA tournament, valued itself at $65 million per year. How do you think that deal is going to affect the way that this, all this is covered and broadcast going forward?
Well, first of all, the deal doubles, you know, the monetary value of the women's basketball tournament alone, which is really, really significant in that the NCAA is going to have more money and fewer excuses to not promote that tournament, to not make the quality of, you know, like almost like, you know, the quality of life for the players and coaches who are participating in the tournament better, which they've obviously made a lot of strides in the last couple of years. But they're going to be able to invest, hopefully, with a unit system, a system of prize money awarded to women's teams, similar to what has been happening with the men's teams. Obviously, more money equals, you know, better product, better everything. But a lot of women's coaches have said, even if you don't win a unit, the idea that you could win a unit is going to inherently increase the on-campus investment and the women's basketball product as a whole. We don't have confirmation that this new media deal is going to lead to that, but the NCAA has said it's enough money that they're going to look into trying to create a unit structure. And then the other thing I'll point to is just like, ESPN has committed to a lot of really in-depth coverage of the women's game. And I'm not just talking about like putting the championship on ABC. I'm talking about documentary style storytelling and journalism that usually is not included in any sports media deal. So I think the quality of coverage is going to continue to improve, as well as, you know, just the money aspect of it and the putting more games on TV aspect of it.
And as long as we're talking about the structure of, you know, men's and women's college basketball, how are the Final Fours different between men's and women?
Yeah, I'm working on a story about, you know, just the structural differences between both tournaments at large that is really interesting, because originally going in to this sort of reporting a couple years ago, I thought, or, you know, I think a lot of people assume the way the women do it is inherently worse because it's an equity thing and a cost thing, blah, 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 blah. In many cases, that was true. However, we've reached a point where the women's tournament is doing a few things at the Final Four, for example. They're not playing in a football stadium like the men are. They're not trying to play in a football stadium. They're perfectly content in, you know, a basketball arena. A good basketball arena, right? An NBA arena, but a basketball arena nonetheless. I think that's like the biggest like physical difference that you'll see. And a lot of people prefer the basketball arena to the football stadium. Obviously, it makes more money for the NCAA to do the football stadium with tickets because there's just more seats. But, you know, a lot of people just appreciate the vibe, and like a lot of the seats in the football stadium are like not good is the other thing. I think, you know, the other big structural issue between the Final Four is that the men's Final Four is like a convention. It's like a business networking opportunity where there are all these events that people in the business of basketball go to, and they're all at the men's tournament, and it's happening at the same time as the women's tournament. So you have to choose, right? And that hinders not just what the women can do in terms of their own business of women's basketball events sort of surrounding the Final Four, but just like hinders like a commissioner, for example, who might really want to go to the women's Final Four but has business obligations at the men's. So I think those are the two biggest differences. The basketball arena versus football stadium, I think there's a healthy debate about that. Obviously, I think it would be great if the women's tournament got better, you know, business sort of events and opportunities surrounding it and didn't have to compete with the men's. But I think there's a healthy debate about a lot of the way that the tournaments are structured in earlier rounds as well, which you can read about in my next feature.
All right, everyone, check that out at frontofficesports.com. Amanda Kristovich, thanks so much for joining us on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Even though Owen is out this week, you can still send him screenshots of your reviews for this show on Apple Podcasts at owen@frontofficesports.com for a chance to win a free Front Office Sports hat. Meanwhile, I'll be filling in this week along with my colleague David Rumsey, and we'll also feature conversations Owen recently had with a bunch of fascinating people. Up next, my conversation with Wizards and Capitals owner Ted Leonsis. Fresh off his attempted move to Virginia, Leonsis has plenty to say about how the surprising and revived deal in D.C. came together, what he sees happening in the disruption of regional sports media, his own aspirations in baseball team ownership, and emerging trends in team ownership. We are very pleased to have as our guest on Front Office Sports today, Ted Leonsis, chairman of Monumental Sports and Entertainment, the parent organization of the Washington Wizards, Capitals, Mystics, Capital One Arena, the Monumental Sports Network, and a wide range of other assets across sports and entertainment. I've personally known Leonsis and have covered his pro sports activities for 25 years now, beginning with his original purchase of the Capitals back in 1999. Leonsis is here today, having just completed a major deal with the District of Columbia to renovate Capital One Arena and reimagine the arena neighborhood. Ted, thank you for joining us today.
Great to see you.
So I think the obvious place to start is how this all came together. It was just 4 months ago that you were in Alexandria, Virginia, with the governor, Glenn Youngkin, talking about a whole other project in a whole other place. And usually these stadium things, they take many months, sometimes years to play out. This is a very rapid turn of events. And it sounds like there was a lot of ongoing dialogue between you and the D.C. mayor, Muriel Bowser. But how did this happen?
Sure. Well, I think... you know, words are important. And when we talked about Virginia initially, we said we had reached agreement on a framework of a development, and I hadn't signed anything. I want to reiterate that it's highly unusual, right? That you don't sign anything, you have a handshake. And the governor told us that he was bringing the business plan to a group called MEI, which is all the delegates who look at all the financial impact, tax implications for the state, and that they were a very important group, and that if they signed off on it 100% of the time, the deals got approved. And you know, that's why he wanted us to have this press conference. But you know, I'll remind everybody that there was still a lot of work to do. And when I informed the mayor of what was happening, she wasn't happy. I understand. But I have a deep and long-term relationship with the mayor. And as I explained, I'm very involved with Georgetown University and new hospital that was opening through philanthropy. Revolution is my private equity firm, and we're investing in lots of DC companies. We had the most successful DC-based and most successful IPO with Cava, if you can believe it, right? It's right in DC. And so I'm going to be around. And let's be nice. Let's take the high road. I haven't signed anything, and who knows what's going to happen. And she got to work, and I was very impressed. The first thing she sent me was a link to a new downtown reimagination plan via a committee that she had created. I noted that we weren't on the committee, but it was really well done. And I sent it to all of our executives and said, hey, you should read this. This is well thought out. And then she sent me, oh, here's the crime bill that's going up. And it's sponsored by Brooke Pinto, who also happens to be your representative in your area. And I read and I said, oh, this is good. She has the data on what our arena, our employees, what we generate, what we did for the neighborhood. And as a business person, this would be a really good deal. And it would be a big loss if we left. But she has the data. She knows how much money is being generated. And so she reached out to me a couple of days later, said, I want to make sure you have my personal number. Let's keep talking. And that's why yesterday or 2 days ago, I said, she's the hero in all of this. She never gave up. Every time she would read something that was going on in Virginia, she'd say, you want to talk? You want to get together? Mm-hmm. And then the mall went out of business. That was not a good thing for anybody because, you know, as we're building this advanced digital esports center, we didn't even know who to talk to. We were going to have electricity. And so when we had this list, what's best for fans, what's best for players, what's best for our employees, and then what's best for the community, the thing that was obvious was we didn't have any more room to expand in DC. And this community in Virginia was 70 undeveloped acres. It's the largest undeveloped acreage. It's right across from National Airport. And it's at a metro stop. and we would get 12 acres. We were buying the 12 acres, $130 million is what we're going to pay for the land. And so I said, I can't get over that. I don't know how to innovate and add and make an entertainment district when I don't have the room. And the mayor turned around and found a developer to buy the bankrupt Gallery Place, reached right out to us and said, hey, if you come back, we could partner. And all of a sudden, we had more of a campus feel. We could connect the existing building with the mall. We could take that alleyway where there was drug deals going on and homeless people sleeping there. The new laws did away with open air drug dealing, and we could make that a part of our space, make a new entrance, and adding 200,000 square feet and then having the ability to move atop of the arena and the mall. That's a lot of room. You've been to our Boston facility for the Caps in Virginia. Mm-hmm. That was atop of a parking lot, right? It's the world's highest ice rinks. And it's great. It has a fantastic feel, and it's a big part of the community. So all of a sudden, the mayor was doing the right things as a mayor for downtown and was reaching out to us in a very positive way, while the Virginia deal was hitting all of these political speed bumps. They had nothing to do with my business and league business. It was about politics.
So within all of that, what is now the vision for transforming? You got a 27-year-old arena, this additional space that you're talking about. We've seen a lot of other teams take these sort of middle-aged buildings and try to breathe new life into that. What's your vision for breathing that new life?
Yeah, and you know, obviously we're going to look at best practices, Madison Square Garden. What Philly just did was very instructive. Now, we have a little bit more opportunity to be creative, and we will work with that grid. The players in our existing arena, the whole back of house operation kind of crashed into the player space, right, as you outgrow things. This will give us the opportunity to move some of the backroom operating into the bottom of the mall, that Bed Bath & Beyond space, freeing up a lot of space. So locker rooms, workout areas for visiting teams, for the home team. You just have to constantly iterate. I mean, it's embarrassing right now that the visiting teams go in front of an elevator, you know, and work on bicycles and like it very much like how Madison Square Garden used to be. You know, you'd go to the old Madison Square Garden and there'd be bicycles and bathrooms and it just wasn't the room. So we have a plan on how to open up that area to benefit the players. Then on the main bowl, we're very intent on better sight lines and trying to reaffirm the bowl structure so that there's more downstairs than upstairs. You know, 20 years ago, the overall feeling was smaller downstairs, bigger upstairs, and price it that way. And when you go to many arenas, you'll see a lot of the seats that are unsold are upstairs, the cheapest tickets. Mm-hmm. And you know, through our data analysis, through our focus grouping, you know, a lot of families would say, I'll buy a great television, I'll watch games at home, I'll stream them, and I'll come to 4 or 5 games and sit downstairs and pay the freight to be close to the action. And so just about every arena is looking at how do you make more inventory and services closer to the action, more suites, more bunker suites, more personalized suites. And then, you know, there's an arms race in plumbing. Steve Ballmer has made an arms race in plumbing. Yes. And it's serious. If you remember, I asked people what did they want? And they wanted things on urinals. They wanted better toilets.
And well, more of them.
Yeah, and we have to make investments in that. Outside the arena, we want to be able to program both inside and outside. And, you know, maybe we can move the Wizards practice facility and build it atop this extended street now, which would be our building and the mall. And this is a way now for us to say two professional teams are making a big commitment. You know, I bet all in between the city's money, which only can get spent in the building.
Yep.
The way it's structured, their monies only go into the building. And we're signing a 25-year lease extension. But then all the other stuff that we've been talking about, we pay for, just like we paid for the new studio and the esports area. And so this will be a great example of public and private investment to restart a community that is really one of the city's priorities.
Going back to the Virginia situation for a moment, though, as this was all playing out and you obviously had the opposition that you did, particularly in the state Senate there, was there any contemplation of just waiting it out and maybe trying again in next year's legislative session?
The city of Alexandria was considering how could they deal with us just directly if things mm-hmm. didn't go well there. The governor is a one-term governor. He'll leave, you know, in 2 years. As soon as this pivoted away from business and became all about politics, it started to scare us. It's like, mm-hmm. we're not politicians. I mean, I was getting critiqued on why aren't you lobbying Louise Lucas?
Right.
He said, I'm not a lobbyist. I'm not a politician. And so I did have one meeting with her and we didn't talk about business. So when this became not about business, oh, I think this is a risky deal. And then there was silly stuff, Eric. I mean, it was just silly. Someone said, can you believe that they've promoted revenues for this for a hotel for $600, $700 a night? And, you know, my first reaction was, well, you haven't read it. I'm not going to do a hotel. But someone will do a hotel. But Google average room rates at the Mandarin or the Ritz or the Four Seasons today in Washington, D.C. And it was $1,200 to $1,700.
Turning from the venue situation to media, you've got an RSN, and that's obviously a heavily challenged part of the entire sports media landscape. You're in a slightly different situation than some others where you own both the network and the content on the network. But how do you see this whole continued digital convergence continuing to unfold?
So my belief is that we will be a leader and others will try to do this where you want to be in the venues, team, and intellectual property rights business. That's how you'll integrate and you'll get lift in revenues. So we bought our network from Comcast. They had not been investing in it at all, because it was a smaller piece of their world. And the cable side of the world is shrinking. And but it's not going to go to zero, right? And so we looked at this as we need to get our rights back, become a digital first company, integrate and grow the advertising other business side, because the network and the venues and the team, all of that inventory now we manage as one, right? And so we're getting uplift in revenues. And what do we think the world will come to in terms of cable? Will it be 50% of the peak, 60%? Does anyone think it's going to zero? And how long will it take to go to zero? And so we made that calculated assessment that we would always want to be in the terrestrial distribution business. We're having a good year. We're not shrinking as fast as our plan predicted. And then we were able to launch a OTT network, a direct-to-consumer network. And we're able to do a lot of interesting things in advertising, where you can be in the building, you can be on the teams, you can be on the network, and that's given us uplift. So the growth in media sales and sponsorships is offsetting somewhat the meltdown in the deals with the cable guys. And we're, because we have two teams, we have a little bit more to talk about with the distributors. So, you know, we look at all of that as how do we digitize, distribute the info, how do we get subscribers, and over time, that subscription business. And, you know, why I'm interested in baseball is that the issue that streaming media companies have is the cost of acquisition and then the churn out. So people will shop and say, oh, Apple TV or Netflix has a great slate here, and I'll subscribe and I'll binge watch, and then I'll cancel and go to the next one. And we see we're a winter sport, right? I mean, one of the new important reasons to make the playoffs is if you can be streaming or having a partnership with the companies that stream, that becomes important content. Well, if you had a baseball team or you had a partnership with the baseball team, you can sell a year package, right? Or it can still be monthly, but it's 12 months worth of programming.
You mentioned baseball, and your name has been connected to the Nationals situation. That team is officially off the market, but where does that contemplation stand for you? Is that something, should that opportunity reemerge? Is that something you're going to be pursuing?
Yeah, I mean, we've been boiling an ocean at Monumental, as have the Nationals. They're rebuilding their team. We are in a full-on rebuild at the Wizards. We're going to have, you know, we just closed and built the new network. We now have to do the building. We have a lot on the plate, but we have conversations all the time because the learners and we are close, and they own a piece of Monumental.
Right.
And so, you know, I can't predict the future. They know our intentions. And, you know, at some point we'll re-engage. I mean, there's a lot. Their season's just starting right now.
Yep.
Right. The Orioles just sold. They have work to do on their network. But we're very friendly and we're very open-minded. And you know, but we all have our hands full. These are much bigger entities to lead and manage now. you know, these are very demanding, complex businesses, problems to solve. And right now we're focused on majoring in the majors, teams, and now the venue and stand up. You know, the network opened last week. You know, the last three broadcasts, I think, were the first time that we were using the all digital format. You, I don't know if you've seen it. You should come and get a tour of it. It's a huge investment, but it's so radically different. And I'm not taking a pot shot at Masson here. I mean that. But they cut their expenses like you can't believe. And they shoot their after game shows in a conference room. Right. With one camera. And we've got this three floor. It looks like the Turner Network or ESPN, but it's all digital. Right. And so, you know, we want our fans to feel we're going to give them the best broadcast. We're going to give them the best game day experience. We're going to give them the best dining experiences. We're going to work on the traffic mitigation. You know, all of this really is in service to the fans and the players and the employees. But the outcome of those investments will be more revenues. And we give all of the revenues essentially back to the players, and then, you know, servicing the debt, servicing the investments that we make. And so, you know, the business has just gotten, it's the same thing, just bigger. I think you're either making dust or you're eating dust. And, you know, we just want to continue to have that growth mindset.
I was going to ask you the one last thing about team ownership models. There's a lot happening around the PE space in the Middle East. You've got the Qatari situation. I don't know, before you go, if you can speak to that at all briefly, but that was the last thing I wanted to get into.
Sure. Yeah. And so we saw with the football team, it was a $6 billion purchase, and they have the best ownership group imaginable and the most successful owners imaginable financially, Josh and Mitch Rales. And they had to max out the debt, and each of those lead owners had to write massive checks, and then they had to get 18 partners to fill it up.
To pay the bill. Yeah.
And there aren't many Josh Harris's and Mitch Rales there. It's becoming really, really difficult to buy these teams at these prices. And then the venue side of the business, Capital One Arena costs $150 million. That's what it costs when it opened.
Initially to build, yep.
Yeah. And now it's $1.6 billion to $2 billion. So imagine if you're buying a team and then you have to build a new building. So that's why private equity started to come in. And the leagues allowed that to be a part of the syndicate, if you will, to fund it. And the problem with private equity is it's not their money. The private equity companies have limited partners that give them the money, and their deals, for the most part, have a time on them, 5 years, 7 years. It's not lifetime investments. And they need to, the people that manage the private equity fund, they need to make money, right? They charge fees. And so private equity was a good source, a first good step. But I believe that unless we could get pension funds and sovereign wealth funds to come in to the leagues as passive, uninvolved investors, The AT&T pension fund owns the land at Potomac Yards.
Yep.
They've owned it forever. And JBG, a public company, manages it for them. And so sovereign wealth funds and pension funds have to have access to put money to work in these companies. And the leagues did magnificent work in making them very, very passive. They're not involved in any way. And their commitment was, we want to invest in durable, long-term, important businesses. We don't want to take any risk. Well, you know, the Caps are considered a new team in the NHL. We're going to be 50 years old next year. The NHL is 115 years old or whatever we are. The NBA is 75 plus years old. I mean, we fit that. And so you will see sovereign wealth funds and pension funds coming in, especially in big markets. And they don't want an exit. Right. They want to be a part of something for the real long term, which the leagues like, right? Because they don't want this to become a you get in, you get out. You're trying to make quick returns. I mean, you know, I've owned the teams now for a long, long time. You heard me say, you know, how long is the new lease? For the rest of my life.
Right.
Right. Right. And then my son has been looking over, you know, my shoulder on, hey, what are you committing us to?
Right.
And you do have to look at these things over the long, long term. And pension funds and sovereign wealth funds are the best source pool of capital for investments of that kind. And you're going to see, I just read an article today. Mark Tatum said, yeah, there's a lot of discussions going on with a lot of
just talked to him. Yep.
I predicted that. And it's just the next natural extension. But we had to advocate for the leagues to allow pension funds and sovereign wealth funds to invest. And then the league architected what the rules were. And then I had to find, the rules are tough. And then I found a sovereign wealth fund who would live up to those rules. And the league was happy because it was, well, if they'll sign up to that, that's our template to bring in other pension funds and sovereign wealth funds. Mm-hmm. So I view it long term as one of the most important developments. Now, I know, you know, it's the political discussions and the PR discussions. I understand all of that. But they are investors, sovereign wealth funds in every private equity fund. You cannot find a private equity fund that is investing in the sports team that doesn't have a limited partner from the Middle East.
Well, we want to thank Monumental Sports and Entertainment Chairman Ted Leonsis for spending this time with us. Obviously, he's, you know, really at the tip of the spear on so many important trends in sports, and we're going to be continuing to track that across all the front office sports platforms. But for now, thanks, Ted, for the time.
Thank you. It's great to see you again.
That's it for today. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you tomorrow.